Welcome to Herb W. Morgan's Slaying Bulls and Bears, a podcast about economics, markets, investing, politics, and profit. Every Monday, in less than 20 minutes, Wall Street portfolio manager Herb W. Morgan distills the complex and complicated into the simple and sensical. Here's Herb now.
Good morning, everybody. It's Herb Morgan, Monday, March 4th, 2024. I am a Senior Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer here at Cantor Fitzgerald Managed ETF Portfolios. This is my weekly economic and market commentary. As a reminder, you can follow me intro week on LinkedIn as Herb Morgan or on X as ETF underscore strategist. Presentation you are seeing and hearing in the case of the podcast is prepared by Cantor Fitzgerald Investment Advisors for use with investors and financial advisors who are each expected to make their own investment decisions. Nothing contained in the presentation should be treated as investment advice. There are no recommendations for the purchase or sale of any securities. The information contained herein is purely for informational purposes. As such, let's move on. We had another solid week in equity prices, continuing to be led by the S&P 500, which is continuing to be led by the Magnificent Seven, otherwise known as the Mag Seven. S&P 500 up 1% on the week, now bringing the year-to-date total return, we're only 2 months in, to about 8%. Mid-cap not far behind at 5%. Small-cap continues to lag. Value starting to show up there, I suppose, at least on a relative basis. International markets had a strong move last week, 0.75%, at least developed international emerging markets were down slightly. Fixed income caught a bid on economic data that was mostly mixed last week, And let's get into it. Speaking of the economic data, we'll start with durable goods orders for the month of January. Estimated to go down 5%, they were down 6%. After falling 0.3% in December. This was mostly due to a large drop in commercial aircraft orders. You can see throughout history, this is a data series that is essentially very volatile, right? You get big down months, big up months. So I don't read much into it. Although obviously this is an extra secular or non part of the cycle slowdown with Boeing because of the troubles Boeing is having at the moment. But nonetheless, that probably would have been a down number anyhow. Moving on to residential real estate, something that's near and dear to all of our hearts. It's a big part of our personal balance sheets. New home sales were up 1.5%. That was about half the gain that was expected. They're, you know, kind of small-ish gains. Annualized pace, you know, just north of about 600, looks like 25,000 or so. Doing fine, lack of inventory, high prices, affordability, despite the fact that, you know, interest rates are higher, they're normalized, but they're not excessively high or restrictively high. In terms of prices of houses, house price index is measured by FHFA in December was up 0.1%. We'll call that virtually unchanged. So that was sort of less than expected. Year-over-year gain about 6.7%. It has, again, to do with supply. Plenty of demand, large percentage of cash buyers, larger percentage than we've seen in past cycles. Similar report from S&P Case-Shiller. S&P Case-Shiller home price index up 0.2%, right in line with estimates, 0.21 versus 0.20. They're a little bit lower annual gain, but not much, 6.13% from a year ago. So roughly, take your balance sheet, your personal net worth statement, and update that home price on a year-over-year basis there by about 6%. Pending home sales fell almost 5% in January after a big almost 6% gain in December, and they're down 7% almost on a year-over-year basis. Has to do with availability, affordability, the willingness of people to sell when they've locked in long-term interest rates during the ultra-low interest rate era that we experienced as it related to COVID. So there's that. And so that's why that number is going down. There's certainly plenty of demand for housing, let's put it that way. Two measures of consumers' confidence, one put out by the Conference Board, The other put out by the University of Michigan, Start With Conference Board for February, fell from 111 to 107. Estimate was 115, so a little weaker than expected, driven by present situation and expectations. Both dropped a little bit there. The number's not particularly robust to begin with. Most of that has to do with inflationary pressures in retail products, most notably gasoline, in the economy has been coming down. So the numbers have been getting better. That coming down seems to have stalled, or at least worked its way into the sentiment numbers in prior months. From the University of Michigan, their consumer sentiment fell from 79 to 77. Current conditions from 82 to 79. Expectations down a little bit, but we're still well off the bottom from, say, June of 22, about a year and a half ago, a little more than a year and a half ago, well off of those bottoms there. Moving on to GDP. Fourth quarter GDP originally came in at 3.3, was revised down a tick to 3.2, but that is definitely not a negative. We want to look through that data. This was just a downward revision to inventories. While it was actually seen as a positive because personal consumption, which is more important than anything, how strong is the U.S. consumer? It's a consumer-driven economy. That was revised from a 2.8% gain. It was revised higher to a 3% gain. And GDP for all of 2023 now stands at a 2.5% gain. So it was a solid report. It lends to the argument that the Fed does not need to raise interest rates. If jobs are strong and plentiful, as measured by weekly initial claims for unemployment, and the JOLTS, which we'll get later this week, and inflation still above the Fed's target rate of 2% core PCE, there's no indication, there's no incentive, there's no reason to raise interest rates yet. When these numbers start to materially weaken, you will see the Fed, I said raise, you know I meant cut, you will see the Fed then cut interest rates. So initial claims, 215, very, very low. Continuing claims, 1.9, also quite low. Personal income gained 1%. That was more than double the expectation of 0.4%. So that was another sign the economy is strong. Again, no need to cut interest rates. Personal income is rising. Personal spending is rising up 0.2%. So with both of those metrics moving higher, what would be the incentive? You know, we have more jobs than more job openings than unemployed. Again, no reason to cut those rates. And this is it. This was what the whole week was about: core PCE or PCE inflation. The blue line is the headline. January PCE price index was up 0.3%, and is 2.4% higher than a year ago. The core PCE, which backs out food and energy, we're not trying to hide it. They're just putting both in the same report so you can get two numbers and backs out the volatile components so you get a better idea of trend. That's what core is for. Core PCE price index up 0.4 and is now up 2.8% year over year. So when you look at that red line, you know, and it was closing in on 6. It's down to 2.8. Fed's targets too. And you can see they stayed well below 2 for many, many years. And they would begin to, when it started to get higher, get towards 2 is when they started cutting rates. So I don't see, even if it gets to 2, the need necessarily to cut rates unless you have a pickup in initial claims for unemployment, slowdown in the consumer, et cetera. So we continue to watch it every month, continue to hope it goes lower. Obviously, the money supply growth had turned negative. The Fed balance sheet is running off. The Fed funds rate is at 5.5%. But there's still a massive amount of monetary stimulus left over from the COVID stimulus. And we've only barely begun to remove that amount of liquidity from the marketplace. The Chicago PMI was a little different, sort of the outlier. So we have all this basically good data showing the economy growing and expanding. But Chicago area PMI fell from 46, which is contraction, to 44, which is further contraction. And then it was well below the estimate of 48. 50 is the line of delineation. So We can take that in isolation. It's worth noting, but the national numbers are more important. We start with S&P Global. This came out on the 1st, so March 1st. So the S&P Global, U.S. manufacturing, the company is S&P Global. The measurement is the U.S. It always bothers me that the word global is in that name. But the U.S. manufacturing PMI rose from 50.7, which is expansion, to 52.2, which is solid expansion, well above expectations. So remember, manufacturing is about 15% of the U.S. economy. However, in addition to S&P, we get the report from ISM, and ISM says we are still in contraction. And it was actually got a little worse last month, went from 49.1 to 47.8, well below expectations. New orders fell into contraction and employment. So if the ISM number is more accurate, then we are beginning to see the early stages of the slowdown. But in reality, manufacturing has been below that for a long time. And manufacturing alone is probably not enough to bring us into a recession unless it deteriorates at a far more rapid pace because the services sector is so strong. Okay, so that was economic data last week. One of the things we get questioned about, or I get questioned about, Glenn and I get questioned about a lot, is our overweight to U.S. Equities. One, because our clients are mostly U.S. investors and their future liabilities are in U.S. dollars. That just sort of is because. But also, why are we overweight in large cap U.S.? And why are we particularly overweight in technology in the U.S.? And we've been in that position for some time. As you all know, it has served us well. It has been a great performer for the portfolios. And this is just a piece of research that we came across last week from Deutsche that we thought was worth sharing. So if you take the profit of companies and countries around the world, they sort of mix them all together and they put this on this chart. So the US profits at nearly $2 trillion. Then there's something called, we've all heard this now, the Mag 7 or Magnificent 7, which are the stocks NVIDIA, Facebook or Meta, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Tesla. Those companies represent $361 billion, which puts them ahead of all countries except China and Japan. And they're really close with Japan. So just seven U.S. companies equal the total profit about of Japan, more than double that of India, France, and so forth. And then you put companies like, oh, let's put Microsoft and Apple here. Apple's profits are bigger than the profits of many countries, South Korea, Australia, Brazil, Italy, et cetera. It just goes to tell you how it shows you the complete dominance of U.S. corporations in world affairs. In the 80s and in the 90s, we talked about the investing opportunity unfolding around the world as they became consumer economies. China is going through that now. It's all true. It's all happening. But for the most part, those growing economies are being serviced by U.S.-based companies. If you take a look at, say, the Euro Stoxx 50 and look at the largest companies in Europe, and you put them on a chart, you don't see massive technology names. Now, to be fair, headquarters doesn't matter so much anymore. Microsoft is a global company. Apple is a global company. Amazon is a global company whose headquarter building happens to be located in the United States. But if the headquarters building is located in the United States, the stock is listed in the U.S. Index, and therefore we are overweight and continue to be overweight and with high level of confidence in American companies, large cap in particular, and even more in particular, large cap technology companies here in the U.S. Another piece of research I thought was fabulous that I would share with you today is this is the amount of profits made on a daily basis from some great American companies. Yes, that's not a typo. Apple makes $377 million a day. Microsoft, $246 million a day. you know, you go all the way down to a company like FedEx, $11 million a day, Costco, almost $18 million a day. These are very, very significant American companies, and this is one of the reasons we like to stay invested here. In terms of economic data this week, nothing major scheduled today, Monday. We've got services PMIs from both S&P Global and ISM for the U.S., both expected to be above 50, showing growth. Factory orders expected to be down about 3%. We've got the big jobs reports from ADP on Wednesday and the Bureau of Labor Statistics on Friday. We expect a slowdown, as does everybody on the street, in this report on Friday. From the rapid pace in January of 353,000, pretty significant slowdown down to 190,000, unemployment to remain unchanged. We've got weekly jobless claims, consumer credit, labor costs, the beige book ahead of the Fed's next meeting, and the JOLTS report. You can see we're back. We're going to hopefully, according to this, not hopefully, but according to this, we should be below 9 million in weekly, in job openings that we get reported to us this week. Thanks for tuning in. I look forward to being with you again, of course, next week. Everything's available by subscription or podcast. Thank you again, and we'll be back in 1 week.
Thank you for listening to Slaying Bulls and Bears. If you'd like to download the slides for this week's podcast, go to www.efficient-portfolios.com and join our mailing list. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, rate us online, and share with a friend if you found this helpful. See you next week.